Maine's Political Pulse is made possible by listeners and by Lee Auto Malls, delivering lunches to Maine's medical workers all this month to thank them for their dedication. Learn more at leeauto.com.
Welcome to Maine's Political Pulse. I'm Erwin Gratz, joined by Maine Public's Chief Political Correspondent Steve Missler and Senior Political Correspondent Mal Leary. It's the Augusta version of the nuclear option. Democratic legislators this week announced they're preparing to vote out what they call a back-to-basics budget. Steve Missler, what makes this proposal so incendiary is not necessarily what's in it, but how Democrats plan to handle it.
Yeah, Erwin, that's exactly right. I mean, in recent history, lawmakers have generally tried to pass bipartisan budgets. The idea is that both parties working together makes for a better budget for Maine people. I mean, I think that's a debatable point, but regardless, that's the way it's generally worked. So there's this norm, if you will, that budgets will pass with two-thirds support, regardless of which party is in control. Sometimes this works. I think the 2019 budget was a pretty good example. Relatively low drama, strong bipartisan support, done and done. But before that, we had some real nail biters. And not only that, we had a government shutdown in 2017. It was a shutdown full of theatricality and one that seemed entirely motivated by Republicans in the House and former Governor Paula Page, who were upset that Democratic House Speaker Sarah Gideon and Republican Senate President Mike Thibodeau had supposedly cut them out of negotiations. And this year, we had a near disaster when Republicans held out support for these obscure tax breaks after Democrats agreed to provide tax relief on pandemic loans in a bill that made changes to the current budget. And that bill needed two-thirds support to pass as an emergency. They eventually got it, but not before a lot of, you know, thrashing around. All of that recent history, including the standoff we just had, is important context for what Democrats are doing right now, which is plowing ahead with a baseline budget with or without Republican support. By doing this, Republicans lose their negotiating leverage because Democrats won't need their votes to avert a government shutdown later this year and pass the budget. Democrats say it's too risky to flirt with a shutdown or even a budget passed at the last minute because it will come, hopefully, during an economic recovery from the pandemic.
It sets it up for the Democrats to enact their agenda entirely. There will be a second budget bill that will allocate some of the money from the federal government, but also will expand a number of programs the Democrats want. Now, with the biennial budget out of the way, they can use just a simple majority to pass that and cut the Republicans out of any major decision whatsoever, except possibly on the bonds, which do take two-thirds vote by the Constitution. There's no way to get around that one. But with all this money coming in from the federal government for investments, I'm not sure that there's going to be much stomach for doing very many bond issues.
So I'm curious, what is behind this? Was there something in the budget that the governor submitted that Republicans were signaling they didn't like? Or why would Democrats go this route?
Well, I think, from the Republicans' perspective, they say this is silencing their constituents. By constituents, I think what they're saying is they are effectively being silenced. In terms of like what is in the baseline budget that Democrats are about to pass, there's not anything in there that we know of yet that Republicans are upset about. There was some outcry about a streaming provider tax, but that was something in Governor Mills' budget. But this is Democrats' budget because Democrats have complete control over this bill right now. And they have jettisoned any idea of a streaming provider tax on services like Netflix. Democrats are just saying they're worried about a shutdown and its effects on the economy. Republicans say this shutdown concern is a myth that's being used by the Democrats to basically steamroll the GOP. And I think the other thing to be keeping in mind here is we have a gubernatorial race next year. And I think a shutdown would not only be damaging to the economic recovery, but it would be damaging to Governor Janet Mills' reelection chances.
Mal, the state Senate minority leader, Jeff Timberlake, said a majority-only budget vote would break a precedent. Now, that's not quite right, correct?
We've had an actual majority budget in 2005, and we've had the threat a number of times. I couldn't begin to count the number of times when whichever party's in control has threatened to do a majority budget. Republicans talked about it when they held the House and Senate and Paula Page was governor. They didn't go through with it, but but they were using it as a hammer, if you will, to say, look, we got to work together or else we'll just go ahead and pass what we want. It's probably to Timberlake, who served on the Appropriations Committee, a break with what he thinks should be done in the budget, because he worked a couple of budgets there that were very, very controversial to Republicans, and he sold them to Republicans as Democrats were selling parts they didn't like to their own Democratic caucuses.
Was there any significant fallout from that 05 majority budget when it passed?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. But what they ended up doing is passing another budget that, if you will, filled the gaps on the majority budget. Parts of it, I should say, were retroactive, which caused quite a bit of controversy as well, so that you ended up with a budget taking effect in, I believe it was late August, that ended up affecting as of July 1st. But they went forward with it. The Republicans say, oh, we can't do anything about this. Well, they can. They could make this session absolutely miserable. Somewhat like the Congress works, there's an awful lot of unanimous consent motions that go on. You know, dispense with the reading of XXX. Well, any member can object to that and force the reading of a particular bill or a particular amendment. If the Republicans wanted to be totally obstructionist, they could slow this thing down to a snail's pace and really cause some havoc in terms of getting any other legislation through.
Is there any other retaliation that Republicans might take if the Democrats go through with this?
There's bound to be some bond issues that the Republicans want as much as the Democrats, but they could block the bonds, as they have in the past, by not giving it the two-thirds the Constitution requires to go to the voters. So that's probably the most prevalent one that I can think of where they could retaliate. But as I said, this other one is really a nuke option because it would slow the process down dramatically. You couldn't get anything done around here.
Well, when they talk about the nuclear option in Washington these days, they're talking about doing something about the filibuster in the U.S. Senate. Steve, Senator Angus King has had something to say about that.
It seems as though Senator King has come full circle on the filibuster.
A couple of times.
A couple of times, exactly. He had an op-ed in the Washington Post this week that actually chronicled his evolving views on this rule in the Senate that essentially requires 60 votes to pass major legislation. Well, Democrats right now don't have 60 votes in the Senate, and Republicans have shown little inclination to cross party lines. And when they do, Democrats say the counterproposals are unserious. This is how they characterize Senator Collins's counterproposal on the recently passed stimulus bill, if you recall. Well, Democrats would like to pass more legislation, and so now they're talking about changing the filibuster or eliminating it altogether. Now, King, when he first started serving in 2013, he was originally opposed to the filibuster rule because he worried that it was a tool for obstructionists.
Up in Maine, they say the old engine is seized up, won't go. And this, we can't have our political system seized up at the very time that we're facing so many serious problems. So I think it is one of the things that absolutely has to be addressed, but it has to be addressed in a balanced way.
He changed his thinking when Democrats were in the minority because the filibuster was a defense mechanism.
I was very interested to talk to some of the senior senators, Democrats, progressive, strong, aggressive people who want to pass President Obama's agenda, but they were very reluctant to abandon the filibuster entirely because it might turn out to be very important to protect values that they and many Americans hold dear.
Now he says he might be okay with changing it, especially as it relates to this major voting rights bill that Democrats are trying to pass. There's a lot of debate about this in the public sphere. He says he might be open to changing the filibuster to get that through because what he's seeing in other states, not Maine, because Democrats are in control here, but he's seeing a lot of what he called voter suppression bills by Republicans in other states. And of course, you know, Georgia just passed this, you know, a whole slate of these. That's what he's saying. If Mitch McConnell, who's now in the minority of the Republican caucus, if he starts being obstructionist, King is basically saying, well, then maybe we need to change the filibuster for all types of legislation.
Well, finally, Hydro-Quebec continues to spend on ways to bolster its chances of getting that new power line corridor built through the Western Maine woods. Steve, what's the latest on that?
Yeah, I mean, as we discussed last week, Erwin, Hydro-Québec has been spending something like $10 million trying to convince Maynard that this corridor is as much in their interests as it is in Hydro-Québec, which stands to make about $12 billion as the electricity generator for the project. Maine lawmakers are trying to stop that spending because the company is owned by the government of Quebec. Meanwhile, Hydro-Québec is beefing up its public relations team. Foreign Agent Registration Act disclosures, most recent ones that I've seen, show that a DC lobbying firm known as Forbes Tate has hired several Maine-based operatives to help with this public relations effort. They include former Republican State Senate leader Garrett Mason, Kathy Summers Grice, a longtime political operative here, and Crystal Canny, who was a campaign aide for Angus King when he ran for the U.S. Senate in 2012. This is a pretty standard move by an interest group seeking to better understand the Maine electorate or potentially use their clout with elected officials here. But you can bet that corridor opponents are looking at these Foreign Agent Act disclosures and going, see, here they are again. Here's Hydro-Québec doing more and more to try to influence Maine voters.
Mal, anything to add there?
The bills have had public hearing already. And what's interesting is you've got bills from both parties, members from both parties that would put a cap and not allow this sort of spending by a foreign national group to influence a Maine election. So we'll have to see how that comes out.
Mal Earing, Steve Missler, thank you both very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That's Maine's Political Pulse for this week. We update the podcast on Fridays. You can find the latest edition on mainepublic.org or wherever you get your podcast. We broadcast some of the Pulse on Maine Public Radio in the 5:30 half hour of All Things Considered on Fridays. Steve Missler writes a weekly Maine's Political Pulse newsletter that comes out Friday mornings, and you can read it on mainepublic.org and subscribe to have it emailed to you each week. Willis Ryder Arnold is our producer. Music is by Rob Holt. I'm Erwin Gratz. Thanks for listening.